You know, listening without an agenda is about the most generous thing that one can do for another person, in my opinion. Giving someone your attention and your curiosity. So I think it's an act of love. It's about the most universal love language you can possibly have.
Welcome back to Religion to Reality. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowich. In this season of the podcast, we are exploring what it's like to listen as Catholics to people from faith traditions from across the world. In the last episode, we wrapped up our Judaism arc, as we're calling it, hearing from Rabbis Danya Ruttenberg and Paul Sidlovsky. Starting with this episode, we're going to branch now into Islam, the third of the Abrahamic traditions. And boy, do we have a great episode for you today. We get to hear from a Muslim American about what it meant for her to even consider herself to be able to be called that, and what her experience is like, what her tradition is like, what her spiritual practices consist of. I think it's a great dialogue. Today, we're joined by Dalia Mogahed. Dalia is a scholar at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding and CEO of Mogahed Consulting. She previously served as the director of research at ISPU, where she led the organization's pioneering research and thought leadership programs on American Muslims. She is also the former executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, where she led the analysis of surveys of Muslim communities worldwide. With John L. Esposito, she co-authored the groundbreaking book, Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, and was appointed by President Barack Obama to the President's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships in 2009. She has testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations on U.S. engagement with Muslim communities and has been a trusted expert voice in global media and international forums. Her 2016 TED Talk was named one of the top TED Talks of the year, further cementing her reputation as a leading thinker on issues of identity, inclusion, and understanding. Dalia is also the co-host of the Quran Conversations podcast. Her work explores the intersection of faith, identity, and belonging, shedding light on the complexities that often divide us while offering insights on how we can bridge those divides with empathy, knowledge, and most importantly, authentic human connection. Dalia, it's great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So normally I like to ask our guests to start by kind of telling us their story and particularly the story of their, you know, faith life and that picture of you. But I know that your TED Talk goes all into that. In fact, I don't want to dissuade people from watching because I think they really should. There's a reason that it's a top TED Talk from 2016.
Yeah. By the way, we have a TEDx program at the school where I teach, and we've used this talk as an example for students.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
But that being said, obviously, most of our listeners probably haven't listened to it. So I would just give us the gist of, you know, kind of who you are, your background, and all that.
Well, I guess, first of all, I just want to say thank you for having me. And it's just wonderful to be here in conversation with you. I was born in Cairo, Egypt, and I came to the United States when I was 5 years old as a part of the Egypt-Israel peace treaty, which included grants for students in Egypt to come to the United States to pursue graduate work. And my mother, who may God have mercy on her, just passed away, was one of the recipients of a full scholarship. So she came to pursue her graduate work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in civil engineering. And my father followed her to also pursue his graduate work, but he had to figure out his own funding. So that's basically what brought us to the cold winds of Madison, Wisconsin, which is where I grew up. And I had, the upbringing of 0 to 5, which was drenched in faith. My grandfather was a scholar of Islam. He taught at, the top seminary or religious organization, institution of our faith. And it was what I grew up listening to and being taught. And then when I came to the United States, it was a very different culture. So I had to sort of, growing up, rediscover my faith, decide if this is what I believe, decide if this was a religion that I was simply going to be inheriting or one that I was going to be owning and really making my own and believing in deeply. And as I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, a very liberal, progressive college town, I was very influenced by the ideas of this city, ideas of liberation, of gender equality, of racial equality. I'm not saying that Madison, exemplified every single one of these, but it was the value. These were the values people talked about as ideal. And I then, adopted these kinds of progressive values, if you will, and approached my faith now as a teenager with a lot of this as the backdrop of what do I believe? What is true? What is equality? What is justice? What is true human liberation? And I was really into the American Civil Rights Movement. It really spoke to me as something very meaningful about, this country's history. I didn't feel like I was part of it. I always felt I was an Egyptian in America, I was sort of a transplant, but I admired it deeply. And for a book report for school, I stumbled on this book called The Autobiography of Malcolm X. And to my incredible surprise, there was this prominent civil rights leader who actually shared my faith. And I had no idea that, Muslims were in America before, like my own family, practically. So starting to learn about the role that Islam and Muslims played in American history, in Black history, and the liberation story of America, really at the age of 15, turned me from a Muslim in America to an American Muslim. I was able to reconcile these two identities, and I was also able to integrate the ideas of my faith, which had always been taught to me as, a faith of morality and ethics and boundaries, and all of these progressive ideas that I was learning. And so at that point, I started to read the Quran now as a not really a young adult yet, but as a teenager. And I really did, I wrestled with it and I asked questions, I doubted, I truly reflected and finally came to truly believe that this is what was true. And at the age of 17, I then, as a visible marker of that, I started to wear the hijab. And this is when I started college. And I be became a very visible, representative of my faith because of the way I dress. And this was like an added responsibility. And anyone, out there who feels that they're the only woman in the room or the only Black person in the room or whatever, when you're that minority, whether you like it or not, you feel this weight of having to represent your group. And I definitely felt that way in college as I moved through school, which was very challenging. I was a chemical engineering student. Very difficult major where you often didn't do well on your tests, but your grades were visible to everybody, and you feel like you're letting down your community. And I had to unlearn that idea of being a mascot. I had to humanize myself before I could then speak that humanity to others, that we are all individuals, regardless of our background or the way we dress. We only represent ourselves, And so I was very active as a college advocate for different causes, including, speaking out and advocating against the genocide in Bosnia at the time. Very active in the Palestinian liberation cause, and graduated. And kind of went back to being a very private person. After college, a lot of activists don't really have anywhere to go with that. And I got married, I had my first baby, and then 9/11 happened, which thrusts me back into this public facing role of having to not build bunkers and isolate myself, but rather build bridges, and be a voice of connection rather than condemnation. So fast forward, I then graduated from my post college. I did an MBA and I joined Gallup as a consultant, and a couple years with that company, I ended up heading the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, authoring a book, co-authoring a book with really one of my favorite authors, who I never even thought I'd meet, let alone write a book with. So that was incredibly exciting. Professor John Esposito, of course, is a Catholic and professor who just retired from Georgetown University, one of the top Catholic universities in the country. And that book kind of propelled me into a much more public space, especially after being appointed by President Obama to serve on his Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. And it really kind of went on from there. I had other roles that had to do with research and education. And I see myself as a lifelong student who is very excited about the things I learn, and so I love to share them.
Awesome. Great. Thank you for giving the whole trajectory there. Tell me a little bit about the impact of Malcolm X. That sounds like that was a real big turning point.
It was absolutely an incredible turning point. It was a one of the most transformational books I've ever read, and I think no one can read that book and not be changed in some way. What I read in this story was the transformational power of faith. How Malcolm went from being Malcolm Little to Detroit Red to Malcolm X to Alhaj Malik El-Shabazz, and his intellectual honesty to be able to change his mind when better information was presented to him. He did not stay static. He was not dogmatic. He believed what he believed at the time because it was the best information he had. And that he imbued this spirit of human equality that he was able to convey to the world. And it was sourced in faith. His strength, his ability to inspire others, his ability to say, "I used to be wrong." He said, "I used to be wrong" several times when he went from, Detroit Red to Malcolm X. He said, the way I behaved before was wrong." When he went from Malcolm X to Alhaj Malik El-Shabazz, he said, "The way I used to talk, some of those things weren't correct." So the transformational power of faith was one thing I drew from it. The other thing I drew from it is that the Islam helped build America. That was what Malcolm X told the story of the indigenousness of Islam in this country. And when you dig, when you learn more about the history of Islam and Muslims in America, you learn things like, Muslims fought in the Civil War. There were explorers that predated Columbus. Of course, many of the enslaved Africans were Muslim. Some estimate up to a third. So when I am then coming into my rite of passage, my adulthood, and trying to piece together an identity, I have this narrative to tap into, one of the civil rights movement, one of these incredible Black activists who whose liberation theology was sourced in a common faith. And what that gave me was a way to be fully Muslim and fully American at the same time.
Dalia, I think one of the things that inspires me about what the way you speak is, and I don't know if this is the nature of your insights or the way you deliver them, but you seem to be able to pick up on things that are true for you or true for Islam, that somehow become totally applicable, I think, to anyone, and especially as they find themselves situated in whatever faith background they're in. And so I wanted to zoom in on a couple of those things that I know about or that you've spoken about. And one of them is, you actually brought it up, your hijab. My pronunciation of this stuff is so bad. I'm sorry.
You did just fine.
that you mentioned that you were kind of in college, you had this kind of coalescence of progressive values with your traditional faith and all that kind of stuff. And I've heard you say that the hijab was actually some kind of you took for you it was a statement of feminism, even though I think a lot of people would say that it's often perceived as the opposite. So can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. The way I saw it, my 17-year-old self saw it was a declaration of independence from the impossible beauty standards that were being, put on women. It was a way to say to yourself and to the world that I'm going to prioritize my beliefs over conformity, my conscience over conformity and comfort. Women were so often and are so often judged on their appearance, on their beauty. That's why we spend so much money on, how we look and weight loss drugs and, everything else, plastic surgery, hair extensions. We are told to derive so much of our self-worth from how we are perceived by men. And I felt, even as a 17-year-old, that this was an incredibly oppressive way to treat women. And that those, it's not that women shouldn't want to be beautiful, that those that our external beauty should be sort of shamed, but rather it should be privatized. It should be made private so that we as women, as individuals, get to decide who we want to share that with, the man we choose to marry, people who, in our private spaces, but that it not be public and it not be how we are perceived. And most importantly, and as I grow older and sort of reflect, the most important contribution of hijab to me and in how I show up in the world is it reminds me for whose gaze am I showing up? Whose gaze am I prioritizing in the way I conduct myself, in the way I make choices? This idea of double consciousness, a lot of times minorities will talk about this sense of always feeling the gaze of the dominant culture. How is this looking to the majority, the people who have all the power? And it's this internal voice. And for that internal voice to change, to transform where you are showing up for an audience of one, where it is you're on stage only for God, only for the gaze of God, where your conduct, your ethics, whether someone's watching or not, whether you have an audience or not, you are always conscious of God's gaze on you, on your conduct and on your heart. And hijab helps me remember that. You know, there's so much research about how we dress actually impacts our behavior. That's why people wear uniforms. It sort of puts you into an identity that says people like me from this group should conduct themselves in this way. And hijab is this reminder to me, that tells me I am showing up for the gaze of just one.
What you said about kind of you being the one who determines who gets to see what reminds me of something that I think it was Pope John Paul II said about pornography, that he says it's not that porn shows too much, it's that it shows too little. And what he meant was you're not seeing any intimacy between these people, all the things that really should happen before any kind of a sexual encounter, where they actually come to know one another rather than just engage. That's cool.
So, yeah, I mean, first off, thank you so much for everything you shared already, and really, what you wear and how that's connected to your relationship with God is a very tangible thing. So tell me a little bit more about your practices. There is so much like what's the right word to say it? There's so many ideas floating around there as to what Islam's about, what Muslims are doing, and why they're doing it. And I'll say personally, I live in San Francisco. I live in an apartment building. We're a block away from a mosque, and there are many people in my building who pray at that mosque. And it actually reminds me of my days when I was in the seminary studying to be a priest, because it's like, at 5 o'clock, I hear people opening doors and all rushing out to go to the mosque, and there's just a tons of activity early in the
This
morning.
is five a.m., right? Let's
5
just
a.m. Yeah,
clarify.
five.
You
Yeah,
mean
5
not
a.m.
five
Yeah, yeah,
o'clock.
yeah. It's actually even earlier things start up, and there's a profound admiration first off I have with just that type of dedication, with that type of rhythm, and then also just my interactions has been. So they've just been very beautiful exchanges, because I could tell there's just this great there's a great desire to be a friend, like there's a friendliness, and there's not like I'm in my world, this is what I do, that's it. There's an approachability, let's put it that way too. And I'm not saying that everyone acts that way. I mean, it's impossible to hold everyone to the same standard, let's just say. But like, to me, it just gave me a whole new appreciation of Islam just by getting caught up in the rhythm of the prayer, which was, pushing me to be more mindful of how do I structure my day in prayer, which we do as Catholics, actually, and specifically as priests, we're supposed to be praying at certain times of the day and things like that. But tell me about that more from your perspective. And by the way, this is something that maybe you can address too. It's all men praying at that time. So I don't know what's up with that. Maybe you can give me some insight with that as well.
Sure. So I guess I'll start with the core tenet or the core creed of Islam, which is the oneness of God. What I mean by that is it is this, I'll call it radical monotheism. It means that only God is worthy of worship. That God is one, he is indivisible, and only God uniquely is worthy of worship. And so that manifests in our lives as we can't worship money or our ego or fame or the pursuit of our ambition. And as and that's an idea that's very theoretical. And while it's a very beautiful idea, you need tools to actually embrace that and have it manifest in your life to internalize that concept. And so we have all these different practices that, we call the pillars of Islam. They are pillars because they hold something up, and that what they're holding up is this God-centered life. God must be the center of our life's orbit. And what are the tools for that? Well, we have tools that punctuate every time span. So on a daily basis, we pray 5 times a day, starting at pre-dawn. So before the sun rises, we pray. And some people do go to the mosque. It's perfectly okay to also pray at home. So the men, who might be going to the mosque, women are praying at home. I, in fact, went to the mosque this morning at 5 a.m. More men than women. And it's really just a matter of preference of where to pray. We, as women, are perfectly allowed and encouraged to pray at the mosque if we wish to. The idea is, though, connecting with God throughout the day as a reminder of who is at the center of our world. So we don't become, heedless of God, forgetful of God, distracted from who we are and what we should be doing. Praying in congregation in the mosque is really special because then you're connecting your connection with God to a connection with a community, a sense of belonging. And then, so that's once, once a that's every day, punctuating and that rhythm of the day is according to the prayers. I could go on about prayer for a very long time, but just very quickly, we also fast during the month of Ramadan. We also take a part of our residual wealth and give it away, as it's called zakah, which means purification. It's a way to purify our wealth. And then finally, we are supposed to go for pilgrimage to Mecca once in a lifetime. And so if we can afford it, and the Hajj period just recently passed us by. So what all of these things, if you kind of look at them, it's a way to remember God and break our attachments to the things that might demand worship from us. It's a way to make God truly one in our hearts every day, every year, in the way we deal with our money, which is a huge idol that people get caught up in, and in our lifetime. And that's how I see the practices of Islam. They're all feeding into, they're all tools and ways to make sure that our hearts belong only to God.
Yeah.
Have you made your pilgrimage to Mecca?
I have. I went in 2003,
What was that
and
experience like?
it's an incredibly, I mean, it's an incredibly transformational experience. I think anyone who's read the autobiography of Malcolm X knows the impact it had on him to see people of all backgrounds, all in this one space, wearing the same thing in this human equality. For me, it was about not only the diversity that I saw, but the fact that all of us were there because we followed the same prophet and because we believed in the same concept of one God. And that unity of purpose, that sense of belonging to something much greater, was so impactful. Also, Hajj is not an easy thing to do. It is not a spa vacation. It is hot. It is crowded. There's a lot of walking. You're staying in tents. So you are being stripped of your comfort. You're standing in long lines to use the bathroom. I mean, these are the realities of Hajj, and that's not a glitch. That's a feature. That is by design. Because what you're saying is, I will forsake my comfort for God. I will walk in the footsteps of Abraham and his wife Hajar because I love God. His devotion to him is worth me paying thousands of dollars to go be hot and uncomfortable in in another country. And I actually think it really reminded me, in an interesting way of giving birth. So I have two boys. They're now young men. It was hard to give birth. I gave birth without, any drugs. It was a natural birth and so forth. And that struggle of giving birth was part of why I valued and I bonded with my children. And this is how cognitive dissonance works. This is how human psychology works. Something that you work really hard for, you value that much more. And I think part of Hajj is that idea of reconnecting to God in a more authentic way. The other thing about Hajj that's really special is it erases all your sins up to that point. And so you are starting over. You are literally being reborn. So it's something that for me really means a second chance at a good life.
Tell us a little bit more about your fasting practices. I mean, people are familiar with hearing fasting during Ramadan.
Right.
What exactly does that look like? I mean, I've had some Muslim students, and it's been really remarkable in watching them fast. But sometimes I think there's a misunderstanding of how the practice works. So what does it mean for you and how you practice?
Fasting the month of Ramadan means that for the lunar month of Ramadan, which it moves throughout the solar year, and I can explain that in a minute, but it's essentially a 30-day period where every day from dawn until dusk, we abstain from food, water, and intimacy if we're married with our spouse. And so for that time period, from roughly, say 4:30 a.m., if it were to happen in the long, long days of summer, it would be, 4:30 in the morning until 8:30 at night. You wouldn't eat, drink, or have intimate relations with your spouse. And you do that every day for 30 days. At night, you eat. You can, all those things don't apply after dawn. After I'm sorry, after sundown, after Maghrib
Dusk or
dusk, yeah, until dawn the next morning. And so that's what the practice entails in a very summarized way. And the idea is to practice putting our ethics above our impulses. It's building a muscle. It's like a workout. It's boot camp for the soul. I will put my ethical framework above my human drives for a period of time. It is to build this sense of self-restraint so that in, the rest of our lives, we have that muscle strengthened and can conduct an ethical, moral life even when we're tempted. Fasting has so many benefits, I mean, physically, and now everyone's talking about intermittent fasting. But even aside from the physical benefits of fasting, it's a time to pause, to lengthen the space between stimulus and response. And that's really where human freedom lives, is that gap. I will decide how to respond rather than react from a place of autopilot. And fasting helps with that sense of reflection, that sense of I'm in control here. My emotions aren't controlling me.
I know that personally, when I am spiritually doing better, let's just say, and I won't go into that maybe right now, that I kind of look forward to Lent, the Christian period of, you know, it's not nearly as intense as your fasting practices, but you know, we talk about going into the desert and all that kind of, it's a very similar imagery. And then the years where I'm not doing so good, I'm really dreading it. You know, it's like, what, this is going to suck type of thing. And, either way, I may end up having a good experience or a positive spiritual experience, but it certainly helps to be going into it, you know, with that sort of mindset. You've talked about this concept that you've termed Muslim enough, where I think you're trying to give encouragement to Muslims, maybe particularly in America, who, whether they're, you know, kind of, noticeably Muslim, like you have with the hijab or not, but just giving them encouragement to say, you know, look, you don't have to be the expert or something in that, you know, you don't have to be an imam to be able to answer someone's question or that type of thing. Is that, am I understanding that correctly? And I think this is really important for someone of any faith, because I know that Christians struggle with this. I think anyone probably struggles with this, where, you know, you feel like there are very public figures in my religion that know much better than me. They've gone through way more formation or theological training or whatever it might be, and I don't want to misrepresent the faith, or do I don't want to be looked upon as an expert or something like that I'm not, you know, that type of thing. Can you tell us more about, you know, your feelings on this?
Yeah, thank you. I think that it's really about being able to talk about one's own personal experience, both not to represent ourselves as an expert if we're not, and at the same time, not to shy away from sharing your faith experience with someone who might be asking, who's interested, and to feel that you can represent yourself. And so this is the idea of taking away that pressure that I alluded to a little bit before, that whether you're visibly Muslim or you're not, to not feel that you have to, that you have this weight on your shoulder where you're representing 1.5 billion people. You are representing yourself. Make that clear and share who you are. Share your experience of your faith. And that's enough, that you are Muslim enough to do that.
Yeah. John always likes to talk about, you know, we're all sharing the gospel of our lives, right? We're all preaching at that level, even if we're not, quote, a preacher. So that definitely resonates.
Yeah. Like our lives are homilies, as we like to sometimes say, meaning that, you know, just the way that we show up in the world and the way that we are able to see things that are beyond our comprehension from just our natural abilities is ultimately giving some type of witness to how we are encountering the divine, you know, each day. You know, I mean, so much of what we've talked about here is dealing with things that I guess many people would say are very external practices. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the internal aspect of it, of course, is where, you know, the real fruit probably emerges. I mean, there could be lots of people going through the motions, so to speak, and really not even enjoying it, but almost feel a sense of obligation or duty. When does it kind of happen for someone? Oh, let's just use yourself, because we're talking about preaching from our own experience.
Yeah.
When does it start to not feel the like it's something that you're kind of forcing yourself to do, that you've interiorized it in a certain type of way? And it doesn't mean you have to be enjoying it either. It doesn't mean like every day is great. But like, what has that looked like for you, where it's like, oh, I can see the fruit of this, even the days when I don't want to do this or it just is not connecting, I see the fruit.
I see the fruit, honestly, especially when I don't feel like praying. It is especially when I don't feel like praying that I most need to, and I most feel the relief when I do. It's the days when I'm distracted, when I'm busy, when I'm anxious, when I'm frazzled, I'm running all over the place. And then I out of a sense of duty, yes, and a sense of obligation, yes, and obedience, I realize, oh, I have to go pray. And then I force myself to take that temporal sanctuary to pull myself out of the chaos and out of the madness, the urgency of my life, of the mundane, and connect to the miraculous, and just take that quiet space. And then I realize how much I needed that relief. But if I didn't feel a sense of obligation, if I didn't feel like I had to obey, those urgent life, patterns would just take over. I wouldn't force myself to stop. And then it wouldn't happen at all. It would only happen when I felt like it. And when I feel like it is when I probably need it the least. So I think it's very counterintuitive for many of us, in modern society, to think about things being obligations, or to think about having a sense of, devotion to something higher than ourselves that we must obey, where we're not just obeying our thirst, we're not just obeying our whims, we're obeying a higher power. And in so doing, we are giving ourselves exactly what we need in that moment, because our prayers don't benefit God. God is in no need of our prayers. He is all powerful. He gives us these obligations for our own good. So the sense of obligation is part of the relief. And I've had this happen many, many times. Same with Ramadan, same with zakah, which is giving away money. We're very attached to our money, right? And so residual wealth means wealth you've had for a year that you didn't use. 2.5% of that, not your income, but what you have left over. And we're still attached. It's still too much to be giving away. So it's precisely because it's an obligation that it breaks an attachment when you do it. It does the internal work because of the external framework. And I think that maybe this idea isn't always obvious. I hear a lot of people saying things like, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. And I think I know what they mean by that. That you don't want all the pomp and circumstance of religion. Organized religion has all these problems and so forth. But for me, you can't decouple the spiritual and the framework of law and obligation. You can't decouple them, because we are always in obedience to something. We're always obeying somebody and something. Whether we know it or not, it's usually our own drives, our own thirsts, our own desires. So we're in obedience to something. We are surrendering and submitting to something. If that's not God, then we become enslaved. The only way to truly liberate ourselves is to surrender to God. And in so doing, that spiritual explosion occurs, that spiritual release comes in by that surrender. And so I don't see the law and the love as being in opposition. I think they need each other. You need a vessel for to hold that love that God is pouring into all of us.
Amen. You host a podcast yourself,
Yes.
Quran Conversations. And I think, tell me if I'm wrong, that the goal is sort of to make the Quran more accessible to kind of just the everyday person.
Yes.
And it seems like you're doing that. So I wondered, how are you doing that? How do you help make the Quran more accessible, more relevant to kind of just the everyday person?
So I'm so glad you asked me. This is one of my absolute passion projects. Quran Conversations, our tagline is for anyone wishing to unlock the meaning and healing power of the Quran. So we believe, and the Quran says about itself that it is a healing, that it there is healing in it. And so to unlock that healing, you have to read and reflect on it. And the way we do that is it's a conversation between myself and a scholar of the Quran, which I do not claim to be. I'm a student of the Quran. And it's discussing verse by verse a particular chapter. So we started with the story of Yusuf or Joseph, which is extremely detailed in the Quran. And we discussed how, verse by verse, how his story is relevant to our lives today, how the lessons from that story of family conflict, of family betrayal, of wrongful imprisonment, of temptation, of then, eventually being in power, and how that may have been the hardest test. So how does the story of Yusuf, the story of Joseph and Jacob and his brothers, relate to our lives today? What lessons can we draw from this story? And that's what that conversation is about. So every episode, we just take sometimes only two or three verses and just reflect deeply on them and draw out those lessons.
Right. Tell us, because I'm sure a lot of Catholics, Christians who'd be listening. Tell us from your standpoint where Jesus fits into the whole Quran and just in the tradition of the prophets and within Islam.
Jesus is a venerated prophet in Islam. So he is understood to be a messenger and a prophet from God, sent and born to a virgin, spoke in the cradle, performed miracles, including even miracles he doesn't perform in the modern Bible. In the Quran, he performs a miracle where he fashions a bird out of clay and breathes life into it with the permission of God. So he is a loved and very important prophet of Islam, meaning the word Islam meaning surrender to God. So what we believe is that all the prophets, starting from Adam and all the way through Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, were all preaching the exact same gospel, the exact same idea, which is to make God the center of your universe, to surrender to God alone. So he is in a long line of prophets. We also believe that he was born to Mary, who was a virgin in a miraculous birth. And that Mary is very, very venerated in the Quran as well. And I think that, we have a chapter named after her, named the chapter of Mary, where it tells her story from her perspective about what it was like for her to be pregnant as a single teenager. A young woman who, in a very conservative society, is now pregnant, and how that felt and how scared she was and so forth. And it's a very human, compassionate telling of the story from her perspective. And then the story of Jesus, we believe that he was not crucified, that someone made to look like him was crucified in his place, and instead he ascended to God, awaiting his second coming. And so we believe in his second coming. And I think it's very important that folks understand that I love Jesus because I'm a Muslim. I believe in the truth of his message because I'm a Muslim. I believe in his miracles because I am a Muslim. And I will always guard and defend, the truth of who he said he was. Now, where, we differ from Christians, Catholics, and Protestants is we don't believe he was divine. We believe he was a prophet of God, meaning he was sinless. Everything he said was true. He was sent by God, but that he was fully human, as were all the prophets. We don't believe that God enters human history, as a person, that God and his creation are separate, and that all the prophets were fully human.
And what would the would you say there's a primacy with Muhammad as the pinnacle of the prophets? Is that how you would understand the framework or?
Well, the way we understand it is that Muhammad, peace be upon him, and all the other prophets, he explains it this way in his own teachings. He said there is a beautiful building, and that building has many bricks, and there's one brick missing. And people are asking, who will fill this brick in? And he says, I am that brick to that building. So he is the final brick to a beautiful building. And the other prophets are all the other bricks. So we see him as the completion, the seal of the prophets, the final prophet. And that the Quran came to do three things with the other revelations. So to be clear, I can't be a Muslim if I don't believe in Jesus, if I don't believe in his gospel. That's a fundamental condition of my faith. I would no longer be Muslim if I were to deny him. And so what the Quran came to do was three things in regards to the other revelations. One is it came to confirm the truths of these revelations, the idea of God creating the world, being our creator and sustainer, that we should all obey God, that we should surrender to God, that we are equal in our human family. So to confirm the truth of the previous revelations, to correct the edits and the things that we believe were changed about previous revelations. And then the third is to complete. So it's to confirm, to correct, and to complete. The Quran completes the message, and it is the final message of God to humanity that is now being, preserved as the final message that we should follow. But we do regard Muhammad, peace be upon him, as the final prophet, and that all the prophets have to be honored, and we believe in all of them.
I'm happy to hear you say that because I feel like I'm teaching it the correct way when I'm teaching Islam to my students. Not
That's always a relief, right?
that I haven't done my homework, but just it's nice to just hear it in the flesh, so.
My biggest takeaway from your TED talk was your line about how it's so important not to equate extremists with a particular faith, right? That to look at jihadists as representing Islam is the same as looking at the KKK as representing Christianity or something like that. That's like an insane idea. I really appreciate that. Are there any other misconceptions that you commonly find with the Islam that you would like to kind of clear
How much time do we have?
up?
I think the most important distinction that we really have to make is the difference between an individual criminal and an entire community. When we hear about an act of violence committed by a member of the Muslim faith, how would we feel if that person were of Christian background? Would we blame all Christians? Would we blame Christianity for that act of violence, for that act of bigotry? Or would we see that individual as criminal, an aberration, someone who is deviant? And so I even challenge some of our language sometimes because I say, are they even extremists or are they simply deviant? And I say this because if I am extreme in how I should be with, my reading of the Quran, I would give away all my money. I would fast every single day. That's extreme because those are things that we are told to do, and I'm now taking it, too far, and I'm losing balance. What they're doing is simply deviant. The analogy I sometimes give is this: an extremist is someone who, there's a recipe for cookies, and it calls for a tablespoon of sugar, so they put a cup of sugar, too much of what they are actually told to put in there. But a deviant, the recipe says a tablespoon of sugar, and they put a cup of cyanide. That is what these individuals, I won't even call them jihadists, although I know what you're saying, I know what you mean. These deviants, these political, that practices political violence are doing something that isn't an extreme of something that is already in the faith, but rather something that is entirely deviant, entirely off track. And to understand the difference between someone who has deviated from the faith and someone who is representing the faith.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard it said that like there really are no true religious wars, because if any of these individuals were taking their religion seriously, all healthy religion is basically peaceful at its heart. And that anyone acting in utter violence to bring to the point of war must be acting out of ego or insecurity, or whatever the individual or even a collective of individuals feels like they're facing some kind of insecurity. Your example about like would you blame Christianity for one violent person's actions? In some ways, I would actually. I wouldn't blame Jesus Christ because he was a prophet of peace, like a messenger of peace. But Christianity has really not understood that for most of its history. And so, in some ways, if this thing was happening in the West, in kind of the Christian worldview area, I would sort of blame the Christianity for some of that, because people were brought up thinking that this is totally appropriate in a Christian worldview when it's not. But I know what you mean. I'm not trying to pick that apart.
It's almost like a collective deviation that's happened in some version of Christianity that's happened. There's certain things that have been kind of now codified within Christianity that seem to be so divergent from the actual gospel and the person of Jesus that now it has a life of its own, and now we have to contend with that. I mean, I say that because that's usually the type of students I have every day. Like, well, we thought about the Christianity is all about this, or and like, well, I can understand how that kind of got into the mindset, but that's not nearly as that's really kind of done out of some form of fear that you have to kind of have a very strong type of understanding of the tribe, so you know who's in and who's out, or something along those lines. But I'm sure all religions have, this type of dimension. It's just part of of human nature. The time you when you find something that makes sense, there's a certain sense of wanting to hold on to it for dear life, and also maybe sometimes trying to promote it in certain ways that maybe can be off-putting or whatever. I mean, and I'm speaking from the Christian perspective, from what I've had to experience. I'm not speaking from Islam, but
No, I see what you're saying. I think that in regards to some of these acts of violence that, people read about in the paper, what I think is important to understand is that, every scholar of Islam, every authority institution of any kind of theological authority has condemned these acts of targeting civilians, of violence in the name of Islam against innocent people. So who are they? How would we then, I think if we were to apply this to any other topic, we would never say that someone practicing some kind of snake oil in their basement represents medicine. They are deviating from medicine. They are doing something against what the medical community sanctions. And that's really exactly the same thing. They're not extremists. They're not zealots. They're just doing something incorrect, period. And labeling it as medicine, even though it's actually the exact opposite. It's harming rather than helping or healing.
This season for us has been all about trying to listen and trying to do deep listening without agenda. And so I wonder how you in your life cultivate a posture of listening without agenda.
Listening without agenda is about the most generous thing that one can do for another person, in my opinion. Giving someone your attention and your curiosity. So I think it's an act of love. It's about the most universal love language you can possibly have. So I thank you for doing that. How do I cultivate it? Well, I remind myself of that. To be curious instead of defensive, to see another person's humanity, even if I don't agree with them, to practice the compassion for another human being that I want shown to me by God. So it's really comes down to what I call the platinum rule, which is to treat others as you wish God to treat you.
Wow, great.
Beautiful. I think Jesus said that too.
Dahlia, thanks so much for joining us. This
This has
has been
been a
great.
amazing treat. Such an honor to have you on the show. And thank you so much for all that you've been doing, and also just giving witness to your own faith. I mean, it's inspiring.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate this conversation.
So many great words of wisdom from Dahlia Mulcahy. Thank you, Dahlia. And I just, like I said during the episode, I just feel that the things she says are so immediately applicable. I hope that's true of all that we're hearing from across these people of many faith traditions this season, that it's applicable. The things that they are saying, the wisdom that they impart upon us, are applicable no matter what faith tradition you're practicing. And hopefully that we're learning a lot. I certainly am. And if you haven't already, be sure to go and listen to Dahlia's TED Talk from 2016. Really, really strong. In our next episode, keeping in the Muslim arc, we're going to hear from a Muslim Sufi named Omid Safi. Amazing conversation. Definitely check it out next time. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast. It is also a monthly interfaith gathering online. It's totally free to join. And you can sign up at the Religion to Reality Substack, which you can find at religiontoreality.substack.com. Religion to Reality was created and executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.